Station number 16718, Major Wilfred White, Reel 7.
Seven. Completing your time at the base depot, Mr. White, how did you move to and reach the 9th Battalion?
Well, in the simplest of all ways, we fell in one morning and I was joined by some other ranks. We virtually were put on a truck and we trucked up to the box, we used to call it. The line, the 8th Army at this stage was holding the Alamein line, having just finished the Battle of Alam Halfa, I think it was called, the last battle that Rommel tried to break us and break through to the Cairo area and beyond. But it was successfully driven off with losses by Montgomery's first contact with him. So we were stretched from the Mediterranean. Oh, I don't know the exact distance, but down to the Qatara Depression, and we had total allies represented. We were towards the southern end of the Alamein line. By we, I mean the 50 div. To the north of us, we had the 4th Indian div. To the south of us, we had who was it? I think it was a new division had just come out. And they were there. And we had attached to us a Greek brigade. So we arrived at the box. And we were guided to the battalion, where I met Lieutenant Colonel Andrew Clark, who welcomed me there and wished me well. And I think I immediately asked him if I could be transferred into the DLI, because at that stage I was still a border regimental on the strength of the border regiment. And fortunately that happened very quickly, and I became a Durham man, which I was very proud to become, because it was my county regiment.
You would change your badge at that point, did you?
Very quickly, yes. Yes. Yes, once I had appeared in orders that I was DLI, I got in the full kit. From the battalion command, I was led to the company, which was B Company of the 9th Battalion, commanded by Jeff Beattie. So on down to my platoon, holding the sand, the real thing, you know. I was so excited. The most of the battalion, well, all the battalion was sited on a reverse slope, which meant that we had a considerable freedom of movement because we weren't overlooked, and there was sort of absolutely no risk from sniping fire. But of course the odd shells came over at odd times, and mortar fire, and life was fairly peaceful. We ate pretty well, as I was there later to learn. There was always one hot meal a day. most often stew.
When did the, what time of the day did that come?
It came in the evening, usually.
Was it dark then?
Not quite, no. I don't. The darkness was kept for tasks on the forward slope of the of our position. There was always some wiring had to be done, always patrolling.
Did you have your own cooks with you? Was the food cooked in situ, as it were?
Yes, but they were in the rear, you know, clear, sort of in the transport lines, I suppose. But to tell you the truth, I never met anybody that was cooking, but the blokes were bringing it up in, you know, the, what did you call these cans, the big
Dixies?
Big, large Dixies, and we queued up and got it there. The other thing that came up to the back of the box was a naffy truck. It didn't come very frequently, you know, it was far from being a daily visit, but we were invited to go, you know, under control to the naffy truck from time to time. And, well, I used to go for the, I think there was an occasional bottle of whiskey. Not very frequently, mind. But the thing I really went for in a big way was the tinned fruit. That the tinned fruit juice after a there was never a lot to drink, you know. But that filled a gap. And you know, for a young lad who'd wanted to get in the army, this. And meet real soldiers and real men. This was great. And
what kind of food were you getting?
Basically, stew. And to which there was some dehydrated cabbage and additional dehydrated potatoes. Which always struck me as rather funny, being in the middle of the desert, you know, getting dehydrated things. But it worked. It worked. And then there's the inevitable tea. And I don't think I ever had a pudding, a sweet. But there'll be something. Usually hardtack and marmalade or hardtack and jam. Breakfast was much the same. Hardtack, hard biscuits. Butter, marmalade, and some tea. And
did you say you dug into holes in the ground?
Yes, indeed. I had a relatively palatial one, because I'd taken over some poor sod that had killed or been taken away, but he had a nice. It's just big enough to get a camp bed in, and there were various recesses cut into the wall round the bed where things like shaving gear and I don't know what else, but paper, because there wasn't any paperwork, was there? But things that you want to do. Remember and other things, letters. There's an odd letter, perhaps.
Did you have cover against the heat of the day?
Not that I remember. No, there's no sort of
no tarpauling, anything like
no,
that.
No, no tarpauling or anything like that. No. And I must admit, I was never consciously hungry, thirsty. Bored or over hot, you know, and it was just pleasant because Montgomery's command were very good at one thing, well, not very good at many things, no doubt, but the thing that they specialised on was keeping contact with you. There was messages coming down via the battalion commander and the rest of the organisation. And you felt, you know, you're into something pretty big was happening. as we know it was.
Did you share the dugout with anyone?
No. I seem to remember that the... my dugout really was a sleeping headquarters, if you like. Oh, yes, I had a some sort of telephone. I had a field telephone in that. Stand twos and sort of tactical positions, I had a command post. It was about two or three of us in.
What was the layout of your platoon in relation to where you would be? Where were the men's dugouts? Holes.
Well, remember, these had been previously sighted by... I just don't... But... you're really stretching me now.
What I'm getting at is, were you pretty central in relation to your own... people?
To my platoon, I was central. And slightly forward, if you like. I had some... what we called the reserve... blokes. They were within hailing distance, you know, but behind me. The other two were where I could see what was happening. As part of the, you know, we fitted into a company plan. And 50 yards to the extremes of the positions from where I was. We were fairly neatly grouped.
What constituted... which platoon were you in control of?
Number 11 platoon.
What constituted your platoon? How was it made up?
I had three sections. Each under the command of a corporal or lance corporal. And I had a platoon sergeant. And the section would be about seven men with a Bren gun and extra firepower. We had a thing called an anti-tank rifle. And two-inch mortar. And at the beginning of the thing, I had a Thompson machine gun as a personal weapon, in addition to my revolver. That was more or less so we had the three sections and a sort of a platoon headquarters group. If you could call away the platoon sergeant and a couple of runners and my so-called batman, who was really there to watch my back as much as anything, and the odd runner. But you were so seldom at what you call full strength. You know, there was always... somebody missing for some reason. I reckon we had about two or three weeks of that sort of life before the Battle of Alamein proper started.
So you were in your platoon section on the reverse slope?
Yes.
Presumably then you would have direct contact with your company commander.
Yes, indeed.
And he would, in relation, be further back, was he?
Theoretically, yes. But, I mean, as the picture in my mind, he's slightly further up the hill than my platoon. So I don't know whether, in fact, he was back. But he was in a position to control the other two platoons, the company.
And presumably you'd have a forward platoons and support platoon, this kind of arrangement, did you?
Broadly, yes. Yes, indeed. The idea being you had to be sufficiently dispersed to cover your main fire task for the job you'd been given, and sufficiently dispersed so that one shell didn't, you know, strike lucky. But you had to be close enough for the control. And the control is, you know, incredibly important, certainly when the firing starts and the enemy start appearing.
The platoons that you, or the platoon you've described, would be exactly the same as the other platoons.
Yes, you know, give and take a few, for the obvious reasons.
Because were there company weapons in addition to the ones that the platoons had? I think, were there any particular support weapons that was held at company?
None that I can remember. We had a company sergeant majors alongside the company commander, and these boys turned up with funny sort of things that they'd won, you know. But the really plus support to the rifle companies were at battalion headquarters, where you had carriers and 3-inch mortars, and of course the on tap Royal Artillery, the gunners, you know, with your line communication to them, and machine gun support. It all worked through the battalion commanders in the general fire plan of things, you see. But
did you have, or were you able to directly contact battalion, or did you always go through your company?
It was usually through the company, without a doubt. You went through the company commander. There might be things that you're on detachment where I can't think of an example where you would.
What was Captain Beatty like? He was your company commander, you said.
Yes, he was. He was a Geordie. I came from the Gateshead area. I'm not sure. He's either a schoolmaster or. Well, I'm not at all sure. Remember, I'd only been with the company barely a week when I forget what I was doing, but I was quite occupied near the crest line of the forward slope, having a peep. When the company runner appeared and said, "You've got to go to see the company commander straight away," which I did, of course. And the shock of my life, of course, his command post was a like mine, but bigger. So you could get the people he wanted. So to get into the company headquarters, which had a tent sort of tarpaulin arrangement above it, so lights could be used, you know, and there was a bit of protection. There was a step down into the dugout, and you had to bend down so he didn't carry the covering away. And I bent down, stepped in, and there was the new company commander. It was Teddy Worrell, the chap who chased me round the troop ship, and I thought, oh dear. This could be difficult, but I must say, and that's where attachment is a strong word, but my association with Teddy began, because he was, you know, whatever he really thought of me, he was obviously going to make me do a job for him and for the battalion, and a bit of a chat. And that was it. You know, the incident of an argument on the boat was forgotten. And, well, I think I've told you that I held him in the highest of esteem as a fighting officer.
Who was your own platoon sergeant?
Well, he was a Sergeant Jordan, small, wiry, tough guy, very, very gallant, very brave, regrettably killed, we suspect, by our own artillery at Marath, you know, yet to come. But he had grand control over the men, and he kept them all very cheerful, which is was the main thing. And I was very attached to him.
What was the background to the men that you actually commanded? Were they Geordies or?
Regrettably, you see, we're at the stage where we begin to run out of Geordies a bit. There'd been the 50 Divid had one or two actions, battles, in the Mideast alone, forgetting the Far East and wherever. They were all over the world, you know, the Geordies, weren't they? But we had a lot of South Wales people, in many respects, rather like the Geordies, a small, wiry, minor type of a person who had definite opinions on everything, you know, from football to family to everything, you know. They stood on their own feet. But I rather liked them.
Has any come to mind, any particular ones?
The one that was going through my mind at the moment is a new chap. He was even newer to the platoon than I was. The sergeant came out and he said, "You have to speak to him." So he said, "There's trouble starting." And I said, "What's it all about?" He says, "Well, this new lad is telling them not to eat their breakfasts because it was heart attack. And he wants to strike until we get bread." And I said, "Well, it's laughable, isn't it? You know." He says, "Well, you better frighten him, or you know, I'll bring him in to see you, sir." So he came in. I can't remember his name. And sullen-looking there, lad, you know. And I said, I can't remember how I handled it, really, you know, in detail. But my approach, looking back, I hope, was something like, what's this all about? He says, "Well, we never had any bread, and I've been here for 3 days or something." I said, "Well, look around you. These lads have been out here for X months, and they've never seen any bread either." Use your common sense. Let's have no more about it. No, he wouldn't. He says, "Well," he says, "they're not eating their breakfasts." He says, "I said, have you ever thought the result of this?" Because I had to start bluffing now, you know. And I just think, here's an infantry regiment in the line, and you've created a strike. They're not doing what they should be doing. And I said, "You know what happens to people like that, people like you, who are incendiary?" He says, "No." I said, "Well, they're virtually shot out of hand." I said, "There's no time to have a committee meeting and a protest march." I said, "This is the army now. You'd better get back and start eating your heart attack, because you're going to eat a lot more of it. You'll be thankful to eat it later on." So he went back, and that was the end of it. What the sergeant did to him or said to him, I don't know. But that was the My first trial of strength, you know, faced with an angry man. I found out he'd been driving, a transport driver in the RASC, you know, with going from the land of plenty to the front and back again. So he could see his bread. If there was any bread in Egypt, they'd get the bread. But
when your first, very first moment that you went into your platoon,
mm-hmm.
how did they receive you? How does a young officer, no action, no experience, and you're moving into a platoon with quite experienced people there?
Yes. Well, I suppose I must thank the NCOs, really, because, you know, obviously I was a new boy, and I think obviously I was pretty keen at that stage, you know, and I think they laughed at me a bit. They called me, I had an enormous mustache, you know, and for the boredom factor, I just let it grow. Nobody told me to cut you, but they could see it from behind me, and I think they called me Buffalo Bill, kindly, you know, one hopes, and that's right, I used to clean my pistol every morning when they were on cleaning, before I think I was stopped eventually, I used to fire a round off in the direction of where they were. And I fired one off, and about 60 yards away, an empty tin spun out of the sand, you see. So I tried to look as though I'd done it deliberately, you know. But, that was, I mean, they came when I said come and go when I said go. And
is there an air of awareness or wariness at first, you know, before the relationship start to cement?
Well, I was so ignorant that no. I accepted that they were all far more experienced than I was, and you know, I didn't line them up and give them a speech about I'm expecting you to show me, you know, there's none of this thing. No, I was conscious of the fact that, you know, they were, I had their support and, you know, that was the only example where, mind that pinched some of my water once, and my batman used to put the day's ration of the water, well, less what you're going to get back in tea, for washing, outside this hole in the ground I was telling you about, where you washed everything, including your socks or your underpants and things. And this morning I looked at my bucket and I said, I could see the lime on it. There was only a little bit in the bottom of the bucket. And the lime had gone down. And I said to the son, get as many as you can out. I'm going to have a speak to them, a word with them. I said, somebody's pinched my water. I said, now I'm going back into that hole, and when I come out in 10 minutes' time, I want it put back in there. I said, it's a dastardly trick in the desert to pinch a man's water. I thought I'd done rather well, you know. And of course, when I went back for it, it swiped the whole bloody lot. And that sort of, I accepted that if you act foolish. But they were great, and never, I thought they were magnificent, but I never got to know them well enough, you see, because, you know, a fortnight after I joined them, the Battle of Alamein started. We had one patrol, My first patrol took place about this time.
Can we leave that to the next table? We're nearly at the end of this one.
Yes, of course.
So, in effect, you were there just a short time. So I was going to ask you just how close to the men an officer got in the platoon situation.
Yes. Well, to show you how close you get, one of the first orders that Teddy Worrell made as a company commander was that the officer's loo had to be in the centre of the company position where everybody could see us. And we had to use the thing, including him. And that, you can't get much closer to them than that, can you? You know, I can't remember any incidents, but occasional shell came over as you sat there with your morning paper and